culture. We are living in a North American culture. And within that North American culture, we have a lot of little cultures. Indian, French, we have Mexican, we have even Anabaptist. We have what they call the culture. And Canada has gone ahead and say that they are diverse in their culture, and which is fine. Culture is built over many, many, many years. Okay? A diverse culture is built over many, many years. But if you have a diverse culture in a country, you will have whatever culture is more predominant in that country will be pushing its own ideology. Okay, you understand? It's going to be pushing its own ideology. And then when another culture gets a little bit more stronger, it begins. And so you will have within a culture, what they call the Canadian culture, you'll have a lot of different cultures pushing their own ideology. And how ideology is pushed is by pushing narratives. Constantly. Narratives. And they speak it over and over and over because they want you to adapt their culture. And so the Mexican culture in Canada is hoping that we that are not of the Mexican culture is going to be able to see that they're right in the way they do things. And as will the Indian culture. Some might say, well, I'm just neutral. No, you're not never neutral. You will buy into someone's culture. You'll do that. In a country. And I remember when my parents came to Canada in 1984, they wanted to keep their Mennonite culture intact. But they sent us to an English-speaking school that was pushing a different culture than the Mennonite culture. So what did you have? My father used to say it this way. We come to Canada, we don't speak the German language anymore, and we don't know how to speak English after 2 months we've arrived in Canada. That's a terrible disaster. It's a terrible disaster. So here we go to the Canadian schools, and they're pumping in the Canadian culture that people have designed, that people have made. We're reading books. We're entertained by the Canadian culture, the Hollywood movement and so forth, the feminist movement. We're entertained by them, and they speak into our minds a culture. And we embrace it. My parents were ignorant of this fact, and so all of a sudden they're wondering why we're not speaking German at home anymore. And they had to now adapt to speaking somewhat English. We can understand German, but we started losing the German culture. Very quickly, because we were influenced by a greater culture that had more predominance. Everywhere you spoke English, unless you went to Quebec, you spoke French. And so that was predominating. And so all of a sudden my parents saw things slipping away, their culture slipping away. My sisters, they watched the TV and they saw Hollywood slim, fit young ladies coming about, and they're eating salads and fibers and all that. And so all of a sudden we got introduced into salads. My dad was a meat eater and I was a meat eater. And all of a sudden now we got to eat rabbit food. You got to be kidding me. Shredded carrots and lettuce and tomatoes and, you know, and some salad dressing and something. Little did they know that the salad dressing that they were putting on was just as bad as all the other fatty foods that were out there. But they bought into the culture, right? And so they went to the stores and they bought themselves clothing and stuff like that, that the culture was producing. My mother's wondering why on earth my sisters did not want to wear the flowery dresses anymore. She's wondering what's happened here. And my dad was wondering why he's constantly struggling with his boys, wanting to wear muscle shirts and shorts and go without a t-shirt on. What, like, what's wrong? Now, my dad was not a Bible teacher. He was not familiar with the scriptures, but he was losing his fight for his culture. He was losing it. I'm not here to promote Mennonite culture. I'm not here to promote a Baptist culture. I'm here to introduce to you a Christian culture. That every church needs to have a Christian culture. something that brings us an identity, something whereby people can see us by. It's a culture. You will go down to Toronto and you'll find the Mexican culture, the Indian culture, and they all, you know them by the way they walk, by the way they talk, the way they introduce themselves, by the way their foods are. Everything you know about them is Mennonite, Mexican, Amish, you name it. It's there. It's the culture they have. But where does this culture start? Mark did a great job of talking to our younger. For the most of his message, he spoke to the younger. I want to speak to us as fathers this morning, if I may. I am a father. I've been a father for 20 years. I remember my first sermon I ever preached on marriage. Didn't go so well. I was not even married. And I got shut down very quickly. I don't think it even took a day. I got a phone call and they shut me down. I am not speaking from a perspective of perfection. I am speaking about, I'm speaking from a perspective of my desire and what God is working in my heart. I asked Jake yesterday about kind of what to preach, and he said, "What is God teaching you?" God has taught me in the last 5 years what is most important to a man, or should be most the biggest priority to a man that gets married. I don't know if you've ever noticed in the scriptures certain things. I want you to turn to 1 Peter chapter 3. 1 Peter chapter 3. You know, revival, I'm going to attach the word revival to this sermon. It might get better traction then. Often when someone talks about revival, it seems to get better traction. They can talk about everything else but revival. But if they put revival on their title or in their sermon, it gets better traction. People esteem the message better. I don't want you to esteem it for the sake that I'm sharing it, but I want you to esteem it for the very fact that it's in God's Word. Not revival, but what I'm going to share with you. So the last time I did Bible study, we talked about marriage. We talked about marriage. And I would like to, and I said there's two messages coming. This is the second one. But you know what, wives? You get off today. You know what, young people? You get off today. Today is your day off. But I want to build a culture. The culture starts exactly where God has always started it, and that is with man. So we have a Bible verse here, verse 7. "Likewise, ye husbands, dwell with them according to knowledge, giving honor unto the weaker, giving honor unto the wife as unto the weaker vessel, and as being heirs together of the grace of life, that your prayers be not hindered." I touched on this a little bit the other day. Hindered prayer. Husbands, where does hindered prayer start? We have a very clear portion of Scripture that tells you and I that God will turn away from your prayer life. You as a husband, I don't care how long, how hard you will pray, but if you're going to do one thing not, God will not hear you. He will not hear you. You pray. You go to every single prayer meeting you can find. You spend 5 days of prayer. You do that. But God will shut His ears off if you do something that is very sinful to Him, and that is not dwell with your wife according to knowledge. Can I be that bold with you? If you will not consider the needs of your wife, God will plug His ears. Okay? God will. Too many husbands are bombastic of a man and they do not consider their wife. They will not. We all would agree that revival starts with prayer, correct? We all agree on that. I'm going to talk to you about two areas where God will shut His ears off to your prayers. Two areas. Just two. It's not a 12-point sermon, but just two areas where God shuts himself off to your prayers. Why is it so important that you dwell with your wife according to knowledge? Brothers, do you understand you possess the greatest example of what God is supposed to be like in yourself? How you relate to your wife gives your children an understanding how God relates to them. And that's how they are going to relate to their mother in the future. How they're going to relate to their wife in the future. And this progress continues over and over and over. If you display a proper example to your wife, or you relate to your wife in a proper way, your children's chances of having a successful marriage is so much greater. So much greater. But when you are a selfish individual where you just care about your own way of thinking and you do not consider your wife and so forth, God says, that's it. I cannot bless that man. And thereby your children, your sons and your daughters, they see a very different picture of who God is and what a husband ought to be and what a marriage ought to be. Your children see a very different picture. I will tell you this, a book that Brother Jake gave me years ago, I read the title, I read a couple chapters. I told you that I've never really read a child training book. But this book, I read a couple chapters and it devastated my entire life. Oh, I shouldn't say devastated, but it helped me to understand something. Your children, the easiest for your children, from the age of when they're born to the age of 12, they are easy to forgive and to forget. You can do to mama whatever you want to do, and they'll forgive, and they'll forget. Remember the book, John Dresser? After that, guess what happens? All of a sudden, they become your judge. Your sons and your daughters will become your judge. And they will not let it slide anymore what you do to mama. Because they watch. They watch how you treat mama. They understand there's something going on. And they understand the tension then. They understand the friction. But they also understand the love and they understand the gentleness. They understand that. They understand if you're cowering to your wife. They understand that if you're leading your wife. They understand this stuff. Children are not dummies. God is not programmed to be dummies. They're actually very smart. Very brilliant. I have seven children and I would say to you, I testify to you that all of my children are very smart and they can very quickly add up when they see mom and dad do something. When mom and dad go into the bedroom and we close the doors, they're wondering, what's going on? It can be little Hudson, say a six-year-old. No, is he seven now? Six-year-old. And it can be Joanna, who's 20 and married now. They know what's going on. They can do the math. And they know if there's friction in the home. They know if mom and dad aren't getting along. They do. We want to build a culture. They know if dad is leading the home. They know if dad is protecting the home. See, I read some of, let's call it your reports. Yeah, let's do that. We'll call it the reports. I read them over several times. Most women want a protector. Most women want a leader. It's God-given. It's a God-given thing. That men to protect, to lead, to shepherd, to guide. To be at the forefront when there is hell breaking loose. They're at the forefront taking those punches. It's what they want. Because they're not designed for that. God has not designed them to take those punches. You have been designed for it as a man. Whether you're as skinny as a rail or as you're hefty as they come, you're designed to take the onslaughts of the devil. God has given you that. By his grace, you can conquer any enemy. Paul said this in 2 Corinthians. I'll just read it there to you. I wasn't quite sure if I should take this as my text or not. 2 Corinthians chapter 1. Verse 12. For our rejoicing is this, the testimony of our conscience, that in simplicity and godly sincerity, not with fleshly wisdom, but by the grace of God, we have our conversation in the world and more abundantly to you, word. What was the testimony of Paul's conscience? Simplicity and godly sincerity. To who? To the world and to church people. Simplicity. Many fathers are more complicated than they need to be. Children don't do well under confusion. They don't do well. They don't thrive under that. My wife has often told me, can you just give me a clear answer? And guess what? My children don't do well when I am not clear in the direction that I am going. They don't do well with that. Most women just want to follow. And so you need to be a simple husband. Simple husband. Someone that makes sense. Someone that gets things done. Simplicity is found a negative and a positive. Oh, how long will you love simplicity? That's a negative. But the positive is that when people look into your life, they want to see simplicity. It needs to make sense. The gospel of the Lord Jesus Christ, Paul was very passionate about that. They would not take away the simplicity that is found in Christ Jesus. Too many evangelists make the gospel very complicated. The gospel is not complicated. It's not. The gospel is very simple. We make it complicated. And many husbands are complicated. It's not simple. Children thrive not under confusion and complications. They thrive under simplicity. And they thrive under a godly sincerity. They thrive under that. Godly sincere. Someone that is sincere, honest in where they're at. A father that never confesses his fault is a father that's setting himself up for a fall. What fall is that? That his children can never obtain to where he is. A godly sincerity speaks of the honesty of the father where he's at. He can confess his faults to his children because he wants his children to understand that they can rise up above any challenge in life. A father has a godly sincerity, meaning he's not a hypocrite. He's not a hypocrite. How can a man that has been married 20 years live in a certain sin and get away with it? I don't understand that. Did you know you can fool me here today as we're having lunch and you can sound very super spiritual, but the one person you will never fool is your children. You can't fool them. I could say your wife too, but I want you to understand your wife, well, she's supposed to submit to your hypocrisy, I guess. But when your child becomes at the age of 13, and this is what a lot of parents don't understand, they have opinions. Children have opinions. Who's experienced, those that have children that are above 13, that their children have opinions and they voice them? Someone, come on, help me out. Yes, children have opinions. And sometimes my wife and I, we go home and say, that was embarrassing, they exposed us pretty good. I have to tell my children, please don't expose my nakedness. But children have opinions. You need to learn to walk with your children in those opinions. But guess who your greatest enemy will be? Hypocrisy. Hypocrisy. You might come here and you might say, oh, how much you love your wife. You might come here and you might say, how much you love the brother. And you might come here and you might sound all spiritual. But your children are marking that, hey, the way he treated his mama at home, I'm not sure how spiritual daddy is today. I don't claim to understand all my wife's needs and all her shortcomings and how I can all meet those needs. I don't claim to do that. By God's grace, I hope by the time I'm Mark's age, I'll have them figured out. Maybe I'm a little bit hard-headed. But I'm going to figure them out. I will. My children are growing up. I learned very quickly what John Dresser said was to be true. They start judging you in a very different level. Judgment can be two things, negative and a positive. Your child can sit there and say, the way dad treats mom, fooey. Want nothing to do with it. That's not right. Or he can say, you know what? I like that. I like the way he embraces mom, the way he loves mom, the way he leads mom, the way he cares for mom, the way he shepherds mom. I like that. And he can do that. He'll go do that. Often the lack of leadership in the home or the rise of a woman, and this is, I think, was one of the things that got me in trouble. What was it? 23 years ago. I made a statement similar to this. Often the rise of a woman in the house is because there's a lack of a man in the house. I can say that now. I've been married for 21 years, and I have found that to be true. Often a woman will rise to lead the home, the little children that she has, because the husband is not doing it. And I can't falter for that. I can't do that. So husbands, revival will start when you and I love our wives. That's where revival will start. When you see the needs of your wife are met, that's where revival starts. All right. Reading verse 8 of chapter 3 of 1 Peter. Finally, be all of one mind, having compassion one of another, love as brethren, be pitiful, be courteous, not rendering evil for evil or railing for railing, but contrariwise blessing, knowing that ye are thereunto called, that ye should inherit a blessing. For he that shall love life and see good days, let him refrain from his tongue from evil, and his lips that they speak no guile. Let him eschew evil and do good. Let him seek peace and ensue it. For the eyes of the Lord are over the righteous, and his ears are open unto their prayers. But the face of the Lord is against them that do evil. Would we all agree that Adolf Hitler was an evil man? Would we all agree on that? We would all agree that Stalin was an evil man, correct? In this context, he's talking about brothers in a church. A church group trying to get along. A church group facing trials and difficulties. What would you say is the evil here? Don't answer that, because I might have to say that's not right. Then you're embarrassed. I don't like that. You know how many times I have given a wrong answer? And then the preacher kindly doesn't say you're wrong, but he kindly has to. Those questions you asked, Mark, I wasn't quite sure. Should I say this? Should I not? Because I don't like embarrassed. I'm just a human being. So I've been embarrassed one too many times to have learned from my mistakes. Let's say it that way. What is the evil? Okay, finally, be all of one mind. Okay? Compassion. Having compassion one of another, love as brethren, be pitiful, be courteous. Is that evil? No, it's not. No, it's not. I am not talking about a brother that is living in terrible sin, a brother that is not. I'm talking about you as an individual. Your responsibility to a brother in your midst, to a sister in your midst, is what? Be of the same mind. Be compassionate. Love as brethren. Be pitiful. Be courteous to them. Okay? If they are struggling with something, be compassionate. If they are in need of something, be loving. If they are in pain, endure with them. Be polite to them. These are all words, synonyms that I'm using that the Webster's Dictionary uses when you look up these words. Be tender-hearted. Be pitiful. That's Sister Helen's situation, if I may use you. Sister, I've never used you in a sermon before, so I'll use you this time. Her situation with her cancer. Be pitiful. Be courteous. Be compassionate, sisters, to her. Understanding where she's at and the difficulties she's going through. You have not experienced the difficulties that she is going through. And same thing with Sister Monique, the constant sickness that she has. Be pitiful, sisters. Be merciful to her. Be tender-hearted to her. It is so easy for sisters to be tender-hearted, to be pitiful, to be compassionate. It's very difficult for brothers to do that with each other. And I will say this, and I asked my wife this question this morning, a statement. It's often that it's easier for us as Christians to be pitiful, merciful, compassionate, and courteous to the unbelievers than it is for our own people in our midst. And that's not who Peter's telling to be this for. Jesus addresses this issue in chapter 6 of Luke, how you are to relate to the unconverted. And you know what God says there? That God is kind to the unthankful and the evil. And that he is addressing, he's telling his disciples, to unconverted people, this is your enemies. I want you to be this way towards your enemies. Brothers and sisters, I want to tell you that this here is not referring to your enemies. He's referring to your brethren, your sisters. So he says, finally, I want to tell you something. Finally, I'm going to give you a grand statement here. I'm going to give you the most solid theological statement you'll ever find. Be all of one mind. Be compassionate. One of another. Love as brethren. Be pitiful. Be courteous. And then, and I tell you, some of you know this better than I do, but I looked it up today again. I love those two dots right at the end of that courteous. That's so beautiful. I love when I know something. I love it. I just love when I have knowledge of something. It just helps me so much more. Those two dots after courteous, there are referring, he's going to tell you now, or you can say the opposite, or he's going to try to highlight something about what he just said. And then he says this, not rendering evil for evil or railing for railing. Okay? So I want you to act this way. Now he's going to do a contrast. What's the contrast? Not rendering evil for evil. If one brother in the church does you wrong, what's the natural tendency? Okay? When the world does the world wrong, what's the natural tendency? It's to get them back. Is to get them back. You know how often, it's interesting, I'll say it this way, my wife and I, we're learning in this, and the Lord will have mercy on us, I'm sure. When she did something to me, or I did something to her, you know what? I try to get back at her. You know what that was? Anyone tell? I wouldn't go and point out all her faults. I'd just be quiet. A whole week would go by, and I barely said a word. Did you know my children caught on to that one? Oh, mom and dad are having problems. He just didn't say anything. Or she would do the same thing. I'm not always the most sensitive person in the world, by any measure. And so my insensitivity often got me into trouble. And she didn't know how to deal with that. See, none of you are going to chirp back. Let's say I said to Brother Jake, you know, Brother Jake, that sermon you preached last Sunday, are you serious? That was like out of context. It was not right, brother. That was just not good. Like, I could have done miles better in that sermon. So his response then is, well, the message you preached this morning, are you serious? Like, that was way out of line too. Like railing for railing. Rendering evil for evil. Evil in the Bible is not always Adolf Hitler. Did you know that? Jesus comes on the scene in Mark chapter 4. Let's go there for a bit. Let's see if we can find it here. Mark chapter 3. Sorry. Good thing I got a bookmark there. Well, I thought I turned to 4 and never found it. And he entered again into the synagogue, verse 1, and there was a man there which had a withered hand. And they watched him whether he would heal him on the Sabbath day, and they might that they might accuse him. And he said unto them which had the withered hand, stand forth. And he said unto them, is it lawful to do good on the Sabbath days, or to do evil? What's the evil? Not helping someone out. Is it right for me to do good on the Sabbath? He's not talking about this whoremonger. He's not talking about the lady that got caught in adultery. He's looking at them and saying, is it right for me to do good or evil to this man? The evil is leaving him sitting there on the Sabbath day and not help him. That's the evil. The good is, I'm going to heal you. I'm going to help you. Okay? Turn to James chapter 4. I'm not going to steal your sermon. They want to use how evil is used. Okay, verse 11, speak not evil one of another, brethren, that he that speaketh evil of his brother and judgeth his brother speaketh evil of the law and judgeth the law. But if thou art not a law but a judge, there is no lawgiver, there is one who is able to save and to destroy. Who art thou that judgest another? Go to now, ye that say, today or tomorrow we will go to such a city and continue there a year and buy and sell. They are forecasting their future. We're going to go and do something. We're going to go into a city. We're going to buy and sell and get gain. Okay? Nothing wrong with that, right? Okay. Verse 14, whereas ye know not what shall be on the morrow. What is your life? It is even a vapor that appeareth for a little time, and when vanisheth away, and then vanisheth away. For that ye ought to say, if the Lord will, we shall live and do this or that. But ye rejoice in your boasting. Such rejoicing is evil. So what is happening here? First of all, they're not acknowledging God in their activities. They're boasting of what they're going to be doing. This is what we're going to be doing. You might say, that's not a bad thing. The Bible calls it evil. We have to hang our hat on that one. My point being, evil is not always an Adolf Hitler, a woman caught in adultery. Okay, evil has different connotations to it. It's still negative. Evil is not positive. It's still a negative. So we're trying to kind of feel our way, what does Peter talk about when he talks about not rendering evil for evil, or railing for railing, but contrawise, blessing. Okay, let's go back to 1 Peter. 1 Peter chapter 4, chapter 3, sorry. In my persuasion of the scriptures, the evil he's speaking of, brothers not doing what is rightfully for them to do to another brother. He that knoweth to do good and doeth it not, to him to sin. I forgot to read that. That's in James chapter 4 there. He that knoweth to do good and doeth it not, to him it is sin. So what is the evil here? Brothers not being compassionate. Brothers not being pitiful. Brothers not loving one another. Brothers not being courteous. And brothers not pursuing to be of the same mind as their brother. That's an evil thing. going on. So now, if I have your minds wrapped on that, that's evil. Verse 9 again. Now, rendering evil for evil, or railing for a contrariwise blessing, knowing that ye are thereunto called, that ye should inherit a blessing. It is better, it is more, it is righteous for you to go and be a blessing to your brethren than to do evil. Okay? It is a blessing. You're called thereunto, to inherit a blessing. So go and bless others. Go and bless your brethren. Your brethren will fall short. And they will, it's interesting, the word pitiful, I think in our German culture, that word has been deleted. I don't even know if there is such a, what's pitiful, Jake, in German? Is there even such a word? Maybe that's why we have such a hard time practicing it. Jammerhart. My mom used to use that word. I can jammerhart for air. Come on, yeah, okay. And I think in many cultures, that word is forgotten. And it's always brought into a negative light. Pitiful. Here, Peter's actually asking you to be pitiful. Pitiful to someone that has a certain problem all the time. Pitiful. Being polite to your brethren. Polite. Courteous. You just are polite to them. Being compassionate when they falter, when they fail. Be compassionate. 4, verse 10. For he that will love life and see good days, let him refrain his tongue from evil. So you can go ahead and lash out at your brother with your tongue evil. Come on. Man up already. You might say, well, he needs that. Yeah, likely he does. But the evil here is not talking about a brother that is living in gross sin. It's talking about brothers in your midst that are just struggling. The context being a young church facing trials, facing difficulties in society, marriages that are not functioning right. That's why we had 7 verses about marriage. Okay? We have a boss that might be a tyrant. And here comes a brother. And he comes and his boss, his unconverted boss, is really hard on him. And he comes before you and says, oh, it's so hard. I wish I could just knock him across the face. Like, he's so hard. We'd all be aghast. Oh, he's thinking violence. Most people don't understand. But that brother would never do that. Is it right for him to say it? No. But they want to correct with that with a very sharp tongue. A lot of times that brother needs compassion. He needs to be you need to show pity towards him. I tell you, the amount of times I have said some outlandish things in my Christian life, every time someone would have done that to me, I'd be in the grave. Because sometimes words come out before I actually think. I have some children like that. And one needs to grow in grace in that. There is time to correct, and then there is time to be pitiful. I worked with a boss in a group, in an atmosphere. It was very, very hard. I had 2 people that thought they were Christians, claimed to be Christians, did everything but Christianity. Here my young Christian man just started going to the old colony, young Christian man, and these people were supposed to be examples of Christianity, been Christian for a long time, and they were just really difficult to get along with. And a Catholic individual was a much easier person to get along with. And these, and I could have pulled out my hair, and they almost, these 2 Christians almost made shipwreck of me. Because I could not understand. And there was times I went home frustrated and upset. And if you would have been there and not applied these 4 things to my life, I probably would have made shipwreck. Too often we're too harsh to the wrong people, or we're harsh too quick. We need to learn to be compassionate. You know, you realize the easiest people to correct are the people you've been compassionate to, that you've showed pity to. They're the easiest people to listen to you. It's just that it works that way. I was telling my boys yesterday, we were talking in the living room about customers. And I said, I want my boys to learn to be friendly to customers because it's going to help them out. And I said, I know that if I'm friendly to customers, if they make a mistake and I built a friendship with the customer will likely go easier on them. That's unconverted. I've seen it done. We've made some huge blunders. I've been in business for, I'd say, 15 years. I've been in business and I've dealt with hundreds of thousands of customers. And when you're friendly with the customer and you sit there and you hear their nonchalant stories and you just pay attention to them and, oh, your mother died of cancer. Oh, that is terrible. Oh, well, I feel I'm sorry for you. And you just go along with it. They're so much easier later on to listen to you and to be compassionate to some of your unruly workers. And I have some too. No, Max is looking at Seth, and Seth is looking at Max. But understand, in the church, it goes a lot further. When there is a brother that is being merciful, tender-hearted, you will have say in his life like you wouldn't believe. So, he that will love life and see good days, let him refrain his tongue from evil. Don't lash out at your brothers. Don't lash out at your sisters. You can speak truth two ways. One with love and just truth. And the Bible tells us to speak truth in love. And I have been one too many times where I have spoken truth and I have deflated the individual. I have crushed their heart. And it's hard for them to get back up off of their feet. And I've seen that. I've done that to my children. Where it's very hard. Because I've spoken truth not in love. You speak truth in love, meaning you have the very best interest in mind for the individual. That's truth in love. And you come and understand that you could easily fall that way. You can easily be bent on that. Easily. But our tongue goes forth and shoots like a dart. And it hurts people. Trust me, I could stand here and count of how many people I've hurt with my tongue over the years. And I've been a hindrance in their Christian life. And it grieves my soul today that I was not more careful. Offenses will come, but not by me. At least I hope not. And my lips that speak no guile. I'll get to the second place of prayer. I'll get there, but I need to build my case. Guile, craftiness. Brothers using certain words to their advantage to prove their point, very crafty. Or to hide certain things, to bring theirs about. It's a form of hypocrisy. In church life, brothers and sisters, there should be no form of hypocrisy. Hypocrisy will kill the life of the church. It will drain it dry. And if you may allow me to ventilate a little bit, one of the things I'm finding that there's too many people that you do not know what's going on behind closed doors. And then all of a sudden, years later, it's manifest and you're shocked. Sin. Chaos, confusion, and on the outward, it's perfectly fine. Families being propped up as the golden example, but then when you get into their home and you're like, really? That's in there? Are you serious? You feel like pulling out your hair. This is in my world that I thought to myself, wait a minute, what's going on? Some of these are the most intellectual people, but there's hidden sin in their doors. They're the most intellectual people, but they don't know how to function with their children, and they don't know how to function with their wife. And it's brought huge discouragement to me. But I am thankful for God's grace that He's lifted up every single time. But brothers and sisters, you can manipulate the circumstance in such a way that you look good. Don't do that. And His lips that they speak no guile. I'd rather have you say nothing at all than the most spiritual phrases in the world if you're a hypocrite. I see men that did song leading and they're sleeping with a woman. And no one saw it except for his wife who's struggling at home. That's what I speak about. You know how devastating that is? I speak about fathers and sons going like this, clashing constantly. But out in public, they're fine. Let me ask you a question. Which one of you have seen me and my sons clash? Be honest. Come on, John, you can raise it. Yeah, my wife. Yeah. We do that at home too. Did you know that? We clash too. At home. Naomi got her first experience of it the other day. There was a wordage that they had used, and now we were on the opposite side of the table. She couldn't handle it. But the next morning, this is just Norm in our home, the next morning she gets up and says, like, why are they sitting in the living room chatting and talking away like there's nothing happened? Those things will come, but don't hide them. A normal home will have conflict. When teenagers arise in your home, there will be difference of opinion. You can bank on it. If your child does not have a different opinion than you, I would 99% of the time say, I'm not sure if that's normal. You can challenge me on that. Am I true, Mark? Okay. Got grandpa's word here. My wife actually, while you were sharing here, she said, she's so thankful that a grandpa is sharing to our young people. To think that your children will not, to think you will not have conflict in your home, I think you're blinding yourself. But how you are going to handle the conflict, if you're going to hide it from the church, if you're going to hide it from the brothers, I'm not saying you all say, oh, I have problems in my home, oh, it was me. No. But be honest. Don't use craftiness to make it sound that's better than what it really is. Be honest with yourself and with the church. I'm not a grandpa. And I still have a six-year-old. When I'm 85 years old and my children are all gone and married and have their own children, then the conflict will cease in many areas because they'll have made up their own minds. They've had to move on. So I expect with Roman and Hudson and Tabitha and Ruth to be more conflicts. But how will I walk through them? I'll walk through them honestly. Upright. Okay, going on. I hope I'm not burning anyone's roast. Okay, let's move on a little bit quicker here to get to my point. Eschew evil, good. Let him seek peace and ensue it. The one I want to get to for the act. The relationship you have with your brother is a right for the relationship you don't have is evil. Over the righteous and his ears are open unto their prayer. So what happens if all of a sudden you are not living righteous with your brothers? What is God going to do? Plug his ears. If God is kind to the unthankful and evil people, if He is kind to the unthankful and evil people, and you cannot be kind to one of His redeemed, I think I would plug my ears too. I would. Too much church strife, revival cannot come. It's always someone else's fault, and no one takes responsibility. Same thing in marriage. It's always her fault. It's always his fault. No one takes responsibility. Where on earth are we going to learn to take responsibility for where we're at, learn from history, and actually move forward in a positive direction? The sad thing is we never learn from history. We keep going the exact same thing. And here the same way. For the eyes of the Lord, this is revival. You want revival in your church. You want revival in your heart. You want revival in the whole entire world. For the eyes of the Lord are over the righteous and his ears are open unto their prayers. You want God to meet you at your prayer meeting? Learn to respond properly to your brothers. That's as clear as it gets. Learn to respond in a God-like manner to your brethren, and God's ears are open to you. Listen to the very next thing. But the face of the Lord is against them that do evil. And he's not talking about, God's face is against them. But he's talking about people that in our midst are not practicing the kindness and love of the Father towards their brethren and sisters. So let's start revival there. I listened to a sermon today. I just Googled on and listened to a sermon about revival. Revival. It sounded really good. His first 15 minutes was just how important it is we need the fire of God to come down, and I agree wholeheartedly, but how on earth are you going to get the fire of God to come down? How? Tell me, I need some substance to be able to get the fire of God down. If God is closing his ears to my prayers, then how am I going to get the fire of God down? But the exact same Bible verse he used, turn with me there to 2 Chronicles chapter 7. He used the Bible verse there, and I noted something, and he did address it too. I didn't listen to the whole sermon, but I appreciated it. There's something there. If my people, which are called by my name, shall humble themselves, acknowledge their state, where they are at. Okay? This is where I'm at. We all want the sinner to be broken before God, to be humble, right? We want to see the sinner come before God and say, I cannot save myself. Candidate for salvation, right? Candidate for revival, someone to come and say, God, I've blown it. I didn't do my responsibility that I should have in my family. I didn't do the responsibility. You might say, I have. Okay, good. Remember I was talking about culture, right? You might say, I'm doing all this. Praise the Lord. But we're talking about culture. What kind of culture are you and I going to be building? Right? And we want our young people to have the exact same culture. We want them to take their responsibilities seriously. When they fall, we want them to take that seriously. So we're building a culture. And here he says, humble themselves and pray and seek my face and turn from the wicked ways. And I, from heaven, will forgive their sins and heal their land. Heal their land. Isn't that interesting? Culture. Our young men will gravitate to those YouTube video guys out there that are building manhood and idolizing manhood beyond what is natural. I'm not saying, you might say, not my, but I'm saying in general, young men will do that because they're going to want to find their identity in something. They want to adapt and get accustomed to that culture. But if you and I don't build a culture, they will run there. If we don't get them to something to hold on to, they'll run there. They will go fast. Because that's appealing. It's even appealing to me. When I listen to some of these YouTubers that are out there that are expressing manhood, and they're very close to what the scripture says about manhood, you sit there and you're like, yeah, that sounds wonderful. And then they will gravitate to it. And guess what? happens. Without us knowing, just like my parents, the culture of manhood is not the only thing they will embrace. They will embrace other things that come with that package. All of a sudden, my parents found out that they had no more control over their girls. They had no more control over their boys because they let them feed on a culture that was not right. Because my parents didn't produce a culture. They wanted us to live in their culture, but they didn't come and educate us. They didn't come and walk with us. When I got home from work, when I got home from school, I could do whatever I wanted to. I could. And my sisters could read whatever book they so well pleased. And all of a sudden, my sisters, I remember I was telling Naomi this the other day, my sister, she was, I think, 18 or 19, comes home with a 37-year-old Audi-driving Italian rich boy. And my parents were like, oh, it was not a part of their culture. And so here she was. She was getting serious at the age of 18, 19 years of old with this Italian boy driving a sports car dressed really, really snazzy, like really good. And my parents were like, no way. And they worked hard. I'm not sure how they did it. They used the Bible to prove to her that that wasn't right. He was, I don't know, and I think he was, I think, divorced yet too. And so she was falling in love with him. If you're not going to create a culture in your home and in the church setting that you're part of, you will find that they will gravitate to a culture that they like. Peter is presenting a culture here to you and I. This is the culture that we need to be a part of. This is where we start with. This is where revival starts with. When the church goes back to the scriptures and finds their roots and culture in the scriptures.